if things could be set up for me the way I need them to be, and if I could be who I needed to be, what would that look like? And you can figure that out for yourself, and then instantly you have a judge. And I also think that's part of the reason people don't do it, right? Why don't people look up and move ahead? And the answer is, well, you know, you start formulating an ideal, you formulate a judge, it's pretty easy to feel intimidated in the face of your own ideal. Then it's really easy to destroy the ideal instead of to try to pursue it, because then you get rid of the judge. But it's way better, lower the damn judge if it's too much. Like if your current ambition is crushing you, you know, then maybe you're playing the tyrant to yourself and you should tap down your ambitions, not get rid of them by any stretch of the imagination. But at least put them more reasonably within your grasp. You don't have to leap from point one to point 50 in one leap, right? You can do it incrementally. And then I would say, the idea here is that as you do that, you shape yourself ever more precisely into something that can withstand the tragedy of life and that can act as a beacon to the world. That's the right way of thinking about it. Maybe first to your friends and then to your family. It's like, it's a hell of a fine ambition, and there's no reason that it can't happen. Life is definitely difficult, there's no doubt about that, and it's unfair, and there's inequality and all of those things, and people are subject to all sorts of terrible things. But I also wonder, if you weren't actively striving to make things worse, just how much better could they be? Make no mistake about it, like the first noble truth of Buddhism, life is suffering. This is true, and it's worse than that because it's suffering contaminated by malevolence. That's the baseline. And so that's very pessimistic. But the optimistic part is that you are so damn tough, you can actually not only deal with that, you can improve it. Mm. It's like, that's a horrible situation. But it turns out that I'm armed for the task. Well, that's a great thing for people to know. And I think the fact that we're armed for the task is even more true than the fact that life is catastrophe contaminated by malevolence. We're stronger than things are terrible. And things are pretty terrible. So that means we're pretty damn strong.
Wow.
Yes, it's a very good thing to know. And it's not naive optimism. Yeah. It's a very different thing. It's like, no, things are terrible. They're brutal. And you are so damn tough, you can't believe it.
Why are self-sabotage such a feature? Okay, here's a couple of reasons. The first is that there's a lot of responsibility with success, right? So if you say yes to things and you do a good job and you bear a large burden and you have to carry it, and a lot of that might be success, but, you know, failure is a lot easier than success. Plus, you can complain about it and whine about it and be a victim and, you know, garner all sorts of kudos from yourself and others that way. So there's that. People have a hard time not having the kind of contempt that borders on self-hatred for themselves, partly because, you know, we are fragile and mortal creatures and prone to error and malevolence, and we know that of ourselves better than anyone else. And because we know that, we're prone to punish ourselves and to think ill of ourselves. And, you know, one of the things I learned from Jung was that the injunction to do unto your neighbor as you would have him do unto you was an equation rather than a statement about how to be nice to people, and that you have an ethical obligation to treat yourself as if you're a person of value, even if you don't really feel that you owe yourself, that you owe yourself the same treatment that you would give someone that you cared for and loved. And that's a really hard thing to learn, you know, because you kind of have to detach yourself from your knowledge of all your insufficiencies and your flaws and treat yourself with dignity and respect, at least the dignity and respect due someone who's faulty that could conceivably learn. And that's a very difficult ethical lesson to learn. It's easier to beat yourself continually on the back of the head with a club and to feel it's justified given how much you know about how wretched and useless you are. So let's say there's two reasons. One is that you don't want the responsibility, so it's not really self-sabotage, it's just avoidance of responsibility and consequent failure. And the second is punishment, self-punishment that seems only just given what you know about all your pathology and error and insufficiencies.
There's no saying, oh, the world is safe. It's not safe, not at all. It's not safe. The fact that you think it's safe means that you were living in an unconscious bubble that was sort of provided to you by your culture. It's a gift. And now that's been shattered. And so now what do? Well, the answer is you retreat until you're in your house and there's nowhere you can go. You're the ultimate frozen rabbit, right? And your life is hell because you can't function. The alternative is, let's take apart the things you're afraid of. Let's expose you to them, you know, carefully and programmatically. And then you'll learn that you're actually tougher than you think. You never knew that. And maybe you didn't want to take on the responsibility because, you know, people play a role in their own demise, so to speak. When you had opportunity to go out and explore or withdraw because you were afraid, you chose to withdraw because you were afraid. So it's not only that you were overprotected often, it's that you were willing to take advantage of the fact that you were overprotected and run back there whenever you had the opportunity. You know, so maybe you're a kid in the playground, right? And you're having some trouble with other kids. And you know, in the back of your mind, I should deal with this myself. But you go and tell your mom and get her to intervene. And you know that that's not right. You know that you're breaking the social contract. But it's easier. And so that's what you do. You run off to an authority figure and hide behind the great father, right? Roughly speaking. Well, the problem with that is you don't learn how to do it yourself. So then you have to relearn it painfully when you're 40. So then you take people out, you say, well, what are you afraid of? Rank it from 1 to 10. The thing you're least afraid of, we'll call number 10. So we'll start with that. Okay, well, I'm afraid of elevators. Okay, well, let's look at a picture of an elevator. Let's have you imagine being in an elevator. Let's go out to an elevator and let you watch the terrible jaws of death open, because that's how you're responding to it symbolically, right? And you're gonna do that at the closest proximity you can manage. You find out, you go do that, it works. You're nervous as hell, especially from an anticipatory perspective, shaking. You go out, you stop, you watch it happen, and you actually calm down. You do that 10 times and it no longer bothers you. Well, what you've learned, that you didn't die, but more importantly than that, you've learned that you could withstand the threat of death. That's what you've learned. And then you move a little closer, and then you move a little closer, and then you move a little closer, and finally you're back in what's no longer the elevator from a symbolic perspective. It's a tomb, right? It's a place of enclosure and isolation. And you learn, turns out I can withstand that. And then you're met much more together, much more confident.
Oh, everyone deals with that. Every time you make a status shift, as you move upwards, of course you have imposter syndrome, because when you first make a transition into a new role, you are an imposter because you're a beginner. You don't know what you're doing. And that doesn't mean you're a liar or a fake. And it doesn't mean you should presume more knowledge than you have. It's, what did Nietzsche say? Every great man is an actor of his own ideal. And that feeds into the imposter syndrome in some sense. If you want to move to the next stage, at some point you have to act like you're already there when you're just barely started. And that's not a lie. You know, it's the willingness, it can be, and it can degenerate into a lie, especially if you presume more than you know. But if you move, you know, let's say you move from being an undergraduate to a graduate student. Well, all the other graduate students and the professors know that you're just a beginning graduate student. They're not going to expect as much from you as they would from a more seasoned graduate student. So you have some leeway that's genuine, but you are, you know, the low rung occupier of that role. And of course you're going to feel like you're an imposter if you have any sense, because you're just barely there. You just made the transition. That's okay. You know, that's not a problem. First of all, you have to understand that everyone with any sense who isn't narcissistic feels that. And it's actually an indication of your mental health and your competence, as long as that doesn't become crippling. It shouldn't knock you out. I'm such a phony. Well, don't be a phony. That's the first thing. If you're dealing with competent people and you admit your ignorance, the competent people never judge you harshly for that, as long as you've been paying attention. So
in my classes, for example, people were often afraid to ask questions. And so sometimes I would point to people and ask them if they had a question, especially the quieter types. And they'd be afraid to ask the question because, well, they're revealing their ignorance, and they would assume they're the only person in the room that's that ignorant, but they're not, because if they were paying attention and they had a question, the probability that half the class had that question was really high. It's different if you're not paying attention. And so you can be ignorant. You can be an ignorant newbie, and you can even ask the questions that are necessary to ask in that position and sort of reveal your inadequacy. And as long as you're dealing with competent people and you've been paying attention, they're just going to answer your questions. And then you only have to be ignorant once. That's the thing about asking a stupid question. You only have to ask it once. Then you're no longer stupid.
We have this idea in our society, and it's a very profound idea. And that idea is that the ultimate truth is scientific truth. That tells us that about the nature of the world, and it does that in a final way in some sense. There's no brooking any arguments about it. And the physicists have got it right, and that's why they can make hydrogen bombs, and that's a pretty good demonstration of their being right. But you don't act as if that's true. And you watch things and pay attention to things and are captivated by things that aren't predicated on those assumptions. And it seems to me that there is a problem of what the world is made out of, but there's a bigger problem. And that's the problem of how you should conduct yourself in the world. And that's really what you want to know. People want to know that more than anything. Because you need to know. It's like, here you guys are in university. It's like, you don't know what you're doing. I mean, some of you know more than others, but you're at the beginning of your life, and life is very complex and chaotic, and it isn't exactly obvious, you know, what kind of relationship you should form, or what sort of character you should develop, or what you're going to do for a job, or what's the meaning of life? That's a good one. What's the meaning of life? Well, and, you know, people come to university, at least many of them, and that's kind of what they want to find out. In my clinical practice is that people just have a hell of a time if they don't slot in somewhere, you know. You know, you think, I got to go to work at 9 in the morning, and, you know, I've got this rigid schedule. It's like, it's probably a good idea to be grateful for that, because what I've noticed is that if people pull out from those externally scaffolded systems, they drift. They get depressed, they get anxious, they don't know what to do with themselves. You know, they're kind of like sled dogs with no sled. And we're kind of like sled dogs, as far as I can tell, beasts of burden. Like, we need a load, man. We need a load. The question is, what sort of load do you need? And here's why I think we need that. You know, I've been thinking about how to figure out what's real for a long time. And because I'm an existentialist, I'm operating under the presupposition that you can tell what people believe by watching how they act. I don't care what they say. I don't care what their statements are about their view of reality. Because the correlation, the relationship between that and their actual actions is not, certainly not perfect, and sometimes doesn't even exist. One thing I've noticed is that no one argues with their own pain. Everyone who hurts acts as if they believe that pain is real.
When you're a naive person, you trust people because you think that people are good. And then maybe someone comes along and hurts you, and you think, oh no, people aren't good, I can't trust anyone. And then maybe you're paranoid and you think that people hate you and don't like you and think you're trash and so forth. You don't trust people. But then you figure out, Jesus, this whole not trusting people isn't working out very well, because now I can't get anywhere. And if I ever do meet someone who's trustworthy and I don't trust them, then they're not going to get an opportunity to show me that they're trustworthy. And so then what happens is that you replace naive trust with courageous trust, and you put yourself out there despite the fact that people might hate you and don't like you and think you're trash. The other thing I would say that's more practical, I think you'd find that you only think that when you run away. My suspicions are if you went out and talked to people, like, you'd have to have something to talk about, you know. But if you went out and talked to people you'd find that those thoughts only bothered you for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then you would get over them. You know, a lot of that's high neuroticism, and that's that in the big five aspect scale, that's withdrawal. You're experiencing a lot of withdrawal-related negative emotions, anticipatory anxiety, and the best way to overcome that is to not avoid. So if you find yourself avoiding social situations, then you have to formulate a plan to stop doing that, and then over time your confidence will be boosted.
The thing that I realized was that after a while, if you continue to disprove your imposter syndrome in the real world, you have a challenge, you're adamant that you probably won't or might not or don't deserve to get past it, and then you do, after a while, you have to admit to yourself that your imposter syndrome has nothing to do with your capacity and everything to do with your addiction about feeling like an imposter.
And that does change as people age. Generally speaking, they become more agreeable, more conscientious, and lower in negative emotion. And some of that is that adaptation. You see that you've survived through various challenges, and then you can review that evidence to yourself, but also the people around you bolster you because they have confidence in you, and so their anxiety doesn't trigger your anxiety, and they'll remind you too, you know, you got this, you've done things in the past.
Such a wealth of data, you know, you've done it so many times.
And that does help. I mean, it does help. People get more confident as they get older and they accrue experience because of that. But it's subject to that underlying trait variability and sensitivity to negative emotion. I mean, there's been good psychometric analysis of self-esteem scales and neuroticism scales. And they're pretty much the same thing reversed. And so, are you confident in yourself, self-esteem? Do you lack confidence? Trait neuroticism. And so it is harder for some people because it takes more evidence for them to dampen down their response to threat. We're all adapted to some degree to the failure of induction, right? Just because something happened multiple times in the past does not mean necessarily that it will happen the next time. It's a very difficult problem to solve, how to regulate negative emotion, you know? But I would say that the best way we know is to keep facing challenges voluntarily, pay attention at a rate that works for you, develop your competence. That actually stabilizes the environment around you, so it actually is less predictable and less threatening. Plus, you accrue that evidence, and you get the social support for doing so. That's your best pathway forward.